Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WKY. I am Katerina Stoikova, the host. This episode has been brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I am so excited to have musician Michael Jonathan with me today. Hi, Michael. How are you today?
Very good, and thank you so much for letting me be part of your wonderful program. This is great.
I'm just not going to start from the beginning. I'm going to start the questions from the end. What are you busy with these days?
Well, of course, we have twins, 9-year-old Michaela and 9-year-old Caleb. And we live in a log cabin right outside of Lexington. And of course, I do the Wood Songs broadcast. We just did show number 1,110. And the spin-off program, Wood Songs Kids, is on public television and public radio. It's sort of a Mr. Rogers meets the Grand Ole Opry broadcast, and it's only kids. Song Farmers is having its 8th annual gathering at the Kentucky Music Hall of Fame at Renfro Valley, and these are front porch musicians from all over the nation that are coming to encourage each other and form chapters around the country. And the Troubadour Concert Series is moved to the Kentucky Theater, and everyone from Emmylou Harris to Sam Bush to Riders in the Sky are coming to this beautiful concert venue as the Troubadour Series returns back to its hometown. And in between all that, I've written 5 books and 21. My 21st album will be released later this year, and I'm producing Little Phoebe White's next album, as well as all this is going on. So we stay busy.
My question, and probably what's on everybody's mind, is how do you do it? How do you do it?
You know, I am surrounded by a wonderful community of friends. And Central Kentucky in particular, is a beautiful garden of entrepreneurial love and spirit. So Wood Songs is all volunteer run. Wood Songs Kids is all volunteer run. Troubadour is all volunteer run. Song Farmers is all volunteer run, because there's so many people willing to participate. And all I do is generate the process, so to speak. I sit on my couch at 3 a.m, come up with the idea, and wonder how hard could it be to do something. And then we do it.
So you mastermind it all.
You know, when you love something, you'll find this to be true yourself. You love writing. You love authors. You love people who create with the written word. And it doesn't feel like work, does it? It's something that you love, and which is why you're doing this radio show and this podcast. Your love.
Absolutely.
And yeah. to me, love is the greatest transaction of the arts. We tell this to every artist that comes on Wood Songs. Love is what makes the arts work. It's not money. It's not marketing. It's not underwriters. It's not managers or publicists. It starts with love. If you don't have that, nothing else will work.
I tell people who, you know, ask me about poetry and poetry books, I tell them, you really, really, really have to want to do it.
Yeah. You have to do it because it's part of you.
Right.
And if you do it well, and the audience loves what you do, the audience is going to do what the audience always does. They buy your stuff. They want to be part of what you're doing.
They want some of that love.
Yes. Well, that's the real business model of the arts. Why does Judy Collins come on Wood Songs 6 times for free? Why does Bela Fleck come on Wood Songs for free? Why does Sam Bush and Tommy Emmanuel has been on Wood Songs 12 times for free? Why? Because they love what they're doing, and they want the audience to know that.
And also because they admire Michael Jonathan.
I don't think I have anything to do with it.
I do not believe that for one second.
No.
Creativity versus business. You listed this, and this, and we're going to zoom in on some of these items. But also, you said, well, my 21st album is coming out. Mm-hmm. How do you balance space in your head for the music and the creativity to come true?
You know, you're bringing up a good point, because nothing happens unless you can pay for it, right? You want to release a book. Well,
what do you mean by that? Nothing happens. I don't know if I agree.
Well, if you want to release a book of poetry, you have to figure out how to pay for the print run. You have to figure out how to pay for the layout and to do the cover and to ship it in the mail.
Or find a publisher who takes care of all that.
Well,
that's
where you come in. But a lot of artists have to do it on their own
these days. Yeah.
You know, the music world especially has changed. There's not a single record store chain left in America. And most of the audience don't realize that. All the record store chains are gone. Nobody dreamed 5 years ago that the biggest retailer of CDs in America was going to be Cracker Barrel. You know, so you know, how do artists create the financial transaction to pay for this album and to go into a recording studio? And you know, that's very, very hard these days. It's streaming pays nothing. You know, the way to make a living in the arts, you better love it. Love better be the foremost thing in your heart for what you're doing, because trying to make a living at this is almost impossible, which is why I started the Song Farmers Community.
Tell us about the Song Farmers Community.
The world is full of passionate, talented, motivated, artistic musicians that won't get a manager, can't get a booking agent, will never get a record deal. There's no more record labels, basically. You know, and they're going to be stuck home with all of this passion and musical skill. What do they do with it? My message to them is, change the way you view your music. It's no longer your living. Got to be honest and truthful. You're not going to make a living at this, but it can still be a very powerful part of your life. And the way you do that is you simply change your view of it. You use your music and your art to do good work. Good work is the equivalent of a hit record. If you can do good work with your poetry, your writing, your music, your art, if you can do good things with it, that's the equivalent of a hit record. It actually lasts longer than a hit record.
What I have noticed is that if I feel pleased with myself, with the work that I've done, pretty much nothing else around me matters.
Well, but that's what the audience wants. They don't want you to do it for them. They want you to do it for you. That makes you an original artist. You know, the audience wants to explore the artist. They don't want the artist to cater to them. That's boring.
That's boring, and it's also the definition of pretentious to try to figure out what does the audience think that a song should sound like and a musician should look like. So let me dress up like what the audience expects and show up there and deliver that.
Well, you know, let me say this carefully, because I know there's so many wonderful country music songwriters and singers and artists, but the big complaint about country music is that it all sounds the same. It's formulaic, that you can almost predict what the lyric is going to be. You can predict what the melody is going to be. And that has harmed country music. It's still a very viable format, but where are the Merle Haggards? Where are the Bill Monroes? Where are the Kris Kristofferson's? You know, where are they today? You know, you can hardly find that anymore. And it's because back then, those artists were sitting down writing what they felt. When Kris Kristofferson wrote in Sunday Morning that he was going to go to his closet and pick out the cleanest dirty shirt. The whole, all of country music.
That is just, so relatable, though.
Yes, right. But you don't get lyrics like that anymore.
That's true.
You know, the biggest, one of the biggest hit records in country music was written by Tracy Chapman 30 years ago. You know, and when you listen to her song, she was writing about her.
Yeah.
And her frustration and her wanting to escape this little town and, you know, trying to find a new life somewhere. You know, her song is a plea of desperation, you know, and you don't get that in new songs anymore because, you know, these writers are afraid. They're afraid not to connect with the commercial audience.
Is it fear to not connect, or is it fear to be vulnerable?
You know, I think the forces of the commercial market dictate how these writers write their songs.
Mm.
And in the folk world, which is I'm part of, that it's there's no consequence to that. You write what you want to write. You feel something, you write it. Why? The audience is going to be very minimal. In the end, it's not going to matter. So, like what you just said, you please yourself. You write for yourself, and hopefully that connects to the audience. Great stations like WUKY that plays independent music, you hear songs like that. You know, there's other stations like The Hound that plays, you know, Tyler Childers and Billy Strings and stuff like that. You know, there's a resurgence of radio that's willing to give the unknown artists a chance again. And this is the adventure in music, and this is what WoodSongs has always done, because that's what I believe in. I believe in that kind of music. And I say it on the show every week, you don't have to be famous, you just have to be good. Because that's all this audience cares about.
So now it's time to talk about WoodSongs, and please tell us also about WoodSongs Kids.
Those who know about WoodSongs understand what it's about. It is a one-hour broadcast. We do it at the Lyric Theater. It celebrates the music of America's front porch worldwide. It's on the air in over 500 stations. It airs in 177 nations on the radio, plus the internet, plus public television, plus RFD television. We're on American Forces Radio Network worldwide. And it gives a taste of what front porch music is. It's organic, it's heartfelt, it's not commercial driven. It's the greatest stage in the world, which is your living room couch with your family. This is the kind of music that you hear on WoodSongs. We always feature a kid on every show, and that feature became the most listened to part of the WoodSongs Hour. Became the most highest rated portion.
Why do you think that is?
Because America loves to see its children succeed.
Yes.
And it gives hope for your future without being preaching. But when you see a little 10-year-old girl playing mandolin like Sam Bush, that's pretty inspiring. And so I thought, you know, how hard can it be to create a second radio and TV series just about kids?
How could it possibly be
hard, so,
right?
Yeah, that's right. So we did it. You know, I got with my friends, and we created WoodSongs Kids. And it airs on public television. You can hear it on KET and the Kentucky Channel. It's heading to RFD television. It's on the air on public radio from New Zealand to Florida, including WEKU. And it's a celebration of kids. It's Mr. Rogers meets the Grand Ole Opry. It's WoodSongs, but only little kids. It's adorable. It's absolutely adorable. And to see them on stage, when you have a 11-year-old little boy named Owen can play the banjo like J.D. Crow. He's 11, and he's like, he's got the J.D. Crow thing down, including the claw of his right hand. And, you know, it's incredible. It's wonderful to see that. And, you know, the first season, my little daughter, Michaela, was my co-host. Now we have Sarah Molly B. Cool, who's 12, and she's the co-host of season 3 that starts in June.
You know, in 15 years, when somebody, one of those kids, wins a Grammy, they're going to thank you and Woodsong's kids for having given them their start.
Well, you know, there's a Grammy-winning artist that just performed at Carnegie Hall, and her name is Sierra Hull. And when she was 10, she was sitting in the Woodsongs audience when Sam Bush was on stage, and she was cradling her mandolin. She wanted Sam Bush to sign her mandolin. And so during the show, I said, let's just bring her on stage to meet Sam Bush on the air. And we did that, and she played a song with Sam, note for note, toe to toe, attitude for attitude, every note. She copped Sam Bush. She was 10 years old. And the audience roared. And if you go on YouTube and look up Sam Bush, Sierra Hull, Woodsongs, you'll see this performance. And you'll hear the audience just roaring as this 10-year-old little girl who's now on tour with Bela Fleck. And she just came on Woodsongs again with a little 13-year-old boy that she's mentoring because she wanted him to be part of the Woodsongs tradition. And so that things like that do happen. It's fun.
And that's part of your legacy.
Well, I don't know if it's my legacy. It's certainly theirs.
Well,
it's their legacy.
Yeah, but it's part of the legacy of Woodsongs. Right?
It's Woodsongs is a community of people.
All right. So what I'm asking, and that's the question that I've been trying to figure out how to ask, is about your legacy.
My legacy?
Yes, your legacy. Because starting things, keeping them alive, consistently putting energy in it, taking away from your own creativity to make sure somebody else succeeds, and doing it not for a month, not for a season, but what it feels like for a lifetime, that is like pouring into the small, you know, creeks, right? A big river pulling into the small creeks, and that creates things, and that is legacy.
You know, maybe it is. Yeah, you're probably right. I don't look at it that way, but you're probably right. You have to understand my world. My world in my home area is one thing. My world nationwide is a whole nother thing. Outside of this area, I'm a singer-songwriter and a performer. I never perform in the Lexington area. I do my one little song on Woodsongs, but I know I don't do concerts here. So outside of this region of Kentucky, I'm a concert performer, I'm a songwriter, I'm the artist. Here, I'm the guy that does Woodsongs and Troubadour and Song Farmers and that stuff. So I'm more of an organizer home, but outside of home, I'm more of an artist.
So you have two kinds of legacies.
Yeah, I make my living out of this area. Mm-hmm. I don't make my living here. And so people see you do so much free stuff, and they're like, well, how on earth does that happen? Well, I don't make my living here. That's how that happens. I do concerts and record sales and book sales and stuff outside of this area.
And you're a touring artist, what does it take to do a tour nowadays?
Well, it used to be a lot easier. It's harder now. The pandemic closed down about 30% of the good venues that artists would perform at. And as the album market collapsed, you know, artists don't sell many CDs anymore. As all of that collapsed, the bigger artists started to filter down into the smaller venues, squeezing out a lot of the smaller artists who no longer have a place to play. That's where the song farmers community comes in. That's why there's 97 chapters around the nation of song farmers, because these poor, talented folks have no place to go anymore. Mm-hmm. And they need something to make their music and their art form valid. That's what song farmers does. I'm lucky because I got my start early on, and I have a worldwide broadcast. And so my road value stays healthy, enough to provide for my family anyway. But I don't do that here. I do that away from here.
And what about your writing?
Well, my sixth book just got released with songs 5 plus the Mousy Highway book. I completed the script for the Caney Creek motion picture. I just finished the script for the Van Gogh story. And I'm working on my sixth volume of the Woodsong series, which hopefully will come out with my 21st album later this year.
So what's in Woodsong's book?
Well, this one is like this is Woodsong's 5. Woodsongs is a series of small chapters that have a theme. Woodsongs 5 is all about artists and their backstories. The fact that Vincent van Gogh's famous painting, The Starry Night, he tried to give it away 3 times. 3 times. Mm. And nobody wanted it. Everybody rejected it. They didn't like it. They thought it was no good. And today that painting is insured for $1.2 billion. But he couldn't give it away during his lifetime, not even as a gift. He was refused. So stories like that are in Woodsongs 5. And the next book is going to be sort of an extension of that. Can I read you one of the stories?
Absolutely.
This is one of the stories I uncovered that's in Woodsongs 5. It's about a little boy. The title is They Made Him Sit on a Bible. It was 1944 in South Carolina. He was a young black boy, just 14 years old, barely 5 feet tall. He weighed less than 100 pounds. The jury trial lasted just 2 hours, and he was convicted of killing 2 young girls and sentenced to death in the electric chair. Barely a teenager, scared and alone, he walked to the electric chair after being given ice cream by the very guards who would kill him in just a few minutes. He was carrying a family Bible under his arm. But young George Stinney was too small for the electric chair. His thin, trembling frame wasn't big enough for the helmet carrying the charge that would take his life. So they made him sit on the Bible so that his head would reach the terminals that would kill him. The youngest person in America convicted with the death penalty. He was just a kid. They made him sit on the very Bible he believed in after the jury deliberated only 10 minutes, and that's all it took to take his life, his family, his friends, and his future away from him. 70 years later, he was found innocent, and his conviction was overturned, but it was too late. During the execution, the helmet fell off of him because he was so small. He suffered with electricity surging through his body several times before he finally died, and they made him sit on that damn Bible. So that's one of the stories in Woodsongs 5. And this is true. This is something that actually happened. You know, as an artist, different things inspire you, move you, trouble you, burden you. And when I heard the story of that little 14-year-old boy, I wanted to put that in the book.
Do you have a song about it?
I'm working on one. Hopefully it'll be on the next album. It's a very difficult thing to write. It was very difficult to tell that story in such a short way.
I think you did great. I mean, the story is shattering.
But can you imagine that little boy, 14, knowing he didn't do this? He didn't do this, and they're putting this thing on his head, and they're making him sit on the Bible, and, you know, several times they had to, you know, shoot him full of electricity because the helmet wasn't fitting right, and before he finally died, and then 70 years later, he's found innocent?
Yeah.
I just couldn't.
I think that story's, as I said, shattering.
Well, here's another one, maybe a little more encouraging.
Okay. Okay.
I believe that musicians are part of the greatest peacekeeping army in world history. And we are living at a time, not just in America, but around the world, where we need that peacekeeping army. And so this is one of the chapters in Woodsongs 5. It's called The Peacekeeping Army. I see several social movements growing, some organized, some are grassroots, many are political. I see organizations on the left aiming political rifles at groups on the right, and I see groups on the right aiming political shotguns at organizations on the left, but I don't see them doing anything to help their communities as a whole. I see a lot of noise, angst, and lost friendships, but not many positive actions that actually do helpful things for anyone. So I cast my lot with the true peacekeepers of this earth, those who plant gardens, raise families, support their neighbors, and welcome friends to their front porches, the poets, the artists, the dreamers, and the playwrights, the songwriters, and the visionaries working in the silence of their anonymous life. They are the greatest peacekeeping force in the history of mankind. The arts are valuable because artists get people to stop, get them to stand quietly, and listen. It's physically impossible to fight during the act of listening, and that is what musicians, writers, poets, and artists of all kinds do for planet Earth. They get people to stop and listen. Art and songs are important. They are vital and necessary. There's a reason the Book of Psalms, a book of song lyrics, is the biggest book of the Bible. Stand with the peacekeepers during a time of unrest. Do what you can to turn your front porch into the grand stage of your hometown. Be one of the creative artists who help your family and neighbors to stop and listen.
Amazing. And totally true.
Well, Henry David Thoreau said that in a world of peace and love, music would be the universal language. And he's right. He's right. And I think, you know, that's something that we, I hate the word preach. I don't know the word to use, though, and I don't mean to sound pretentious, but we say it often on the air that these artists are peacekeepers, because a good artist will get anybody to stop and listen. And it's physically impossible to fight when you're listening or now, reading, you know.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Have you ever listened to Russian war music?
Yes. Yeah, music can also get you to...
You know, by the time some of these songs are over, the whole country is ready to get up and fight. I mean, they're so powerful.
And that's where the love part comes in to balance things. Yeah. And this is why I keep saying love is the greatest transaction of the arts. You can use anything for bad. These guys used box cutters one day in an airplane and brought down two huge buildings. Box cutters are great little tools used all over the world to put wonderful presents and gifts together. But you can also use it to take the World Trade Center down in an airplane. Music, at its essence, is an act of love. It can be used for other things. It can be used to sell soap. But I don't think that's the purpose of music, you know. But for me, the average songwriter, poet, and dreamer, these are part of the peacekeeping army.
What is your latest album about? Number 20 and then number 21.
Well, number 20 is called Garden of Silence. And the title cut is all about, it's an extension of Woodsongs 5, mm-hmm. which was a celebration of Vincent van Gogh. And Garden of Silence, the title song, is all about the day van Gogh passed. The old story was that he shot himself in the chest. What has now come out was that he probably had an argument with two young boys, and one of those boys shot Van Gogh. Mm. And that's how he died. He wouldn't tell Dr. Gachet who shot him. He kept telling Dr. Gachet that it didn't matter. So he was trying to protect these little boys, but he lost his life in the process. The movie script, Garden of Silence, which is about Van Gogh, is about what would have happened if, as he died, he got transported mystically into modern day and saw his paintings that nobody liked on coffee cups and billboards and TV commercials. And what would his reaction? He'd be furious. He'd be angry. He'd be hurt. He'd be confused.
Yeah, that would be totally disorienting.
Yeah, and what would happen if he got hired as a Van Gogh imitator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art because he could paint just like Van Gogh? But he is Van Gogh and nobody believes him.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what that movie script is about. And so the songs of the 21st album are going to be what, in my mind, the soundtrack of what this movie should be like.
And what about Elon Musk?
The song?
Well,
you heard it.
I did. I thought it was hysterical.
Yeah, I was. There's a song. If you go to YouTube and look up, or go to my website, michaeljonathan.com/Elon. I wrote a song about Elon Musk. You know, he lost $40 billion. So the man deserves a song after that. You know, but look at what he's done. You know, he's got a great sense of humor. And I sent the song to, I don't know if it got to him, but it got to his folks. And they loved it. They sent a little congratulatory note and, you know, were very nice about it and stuff like that. But the song is about, you know, Elon, this guy who's lost $40 billion that is tunneling under cities, creating tunnels under cities. He's putting microchips in people's brains. He's got, you know, Tesla cars and, you know, SpaceX rockets and internet and stuff like that. I mean, it's a fascinating story. And to me, he's a folk song waiting to happen. So I was like, well, let me write one. And it's right now, it got released to radio. It's being played at about 140 radio stations right now. So,
oh, to me, it's a hit already.
Yeah. It's funny. It's a fun song. Yeah. So go michaeljonathan.com/Elon and you can check it out.
Do you have a song for us that you want to play?
Yeah, this is a song based on a true story written during the Civil War about a young wife whose husband came home from the war, and she caught him under a willow tree with a young blonde girl cheating on her. And the young girl's name was Aura Lee, and it became a barbershop quartet song. And then Elvis Presley changed the words in the title, and it became Love Me Tender. But this is the original song. Has the blackbird in the tree beneath that willow tree sat my love, and I heard him sing to that Aura Lee. My heart was broken, sad and true, for my love to thee. That your heart no longer true, and you gave to Aura Lee. They sang upon that morning star beneath that willow tree. There I laid my true love down, right next to Aura Lee. Aura Lee, Aura Lee, made of golden hair. Springtime came along with thee, and my love so fair. Take my heart and take my ring, I give it all to thee, and keep them for eternity, along with Aurelie. Aurelie, Aurelie, made of golden hair. Springtime came along with thee, and my love so fair. Springtime came along with thee, and my love so fair. It's a pretty old song, isn't it?
Thank you so much. That's amazing.
And it's a true story.
Yeah.
It's funny, 1861 it was written, became popular among the soldiers. Abraham Lincoln got shot. They stopped singing it because it's about someone getting shot. And then turn of the century barbershop quartets and parlor music. It got resurrected because they had a nice chorus and the barbershop quartets could sing the chorus. And then the Depression came, and so they stopped singing the song again. And then 100 years after it was written in 1961 is when Elvis Presley resurrected the melody, changed it into what we know as Love Me Tender. And it's nice to keep the original song alive.
I want to ask this because I've had a similar moment that beyond a shadow of a doubt, I knew that from this day forward, I want to be a poet. I was 8 years old, and then I went home and I told my mother, I'm going to be a poet. And that was that. And I know that you have your own moment when you knew you're going to be a folk singer. Would you like to share that?
Just graduated high school, upstate New York. My neighbor in Beacon, New York, was a delightful older guy who claimed to be a musician, but he played the banjo, which to us rock and roll kids, unless you could plug the instrument in, it's not a real instrument, right? And so out of high school, a friend of mine called me up and asked if I wanted to work at a radio station on the Mexican border. It's footloose and fiance free. I left New York, drove 44 hours straight, which you do when you're young and immortal. I got there and I was working at KVOZ Radio. They gave me the midnight to 6 a.m. shift, which is what they give you when you completely suck. You're learning the trade. And a couple of months in, I was playing a song by Roger McGuinn and the Byrds called Turn, Turn, Turn. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There, and I noticed that it was written by my neighbor in New York. And I called him up. I said, Pete, I just realized that you're Pete Seeger. And he laughed. He goes, yeah, well, I have been all my life. And I said, Pete, I want to be a folk singer too. What do I do? And he said, don't go to school. Don't take lessons. You need to go where the music is and live it. And you need to go to the Appalachian Mountains. So I left Laredo, Texas, and I moved to Mousie, Kentucky, in Knott County, Kentucky. And I went up and down the hills and hollers for about 2 years, knocking on doors, having front porch hootenannies. People would pull out their mandolins and their fiddles and teaching me their songs. I did that for a couple of years before I started my career. But it was that moment, realizing that my neighbor was Pete Seeger, that banjo-playing guy that I knew that I'd play with his kids at his log cabin in Beacon, New York. I didn't know he was famous. I didn't know he wrote those songs.
That says a lot about him as a person.
Yes. Well, he was that way.
Yeah.
He was that way. One of my most endearing experiences with him, and I write about it in Wood Songs 5, not to push the book, but we were playing a festival, And I was standing next to Pete, and, you know, as folks do, they gathered around him. There were about two dozen people wanting to talk to him. And this teenage boy came up to him with a poster. He wanted to show Pete that he was playing at a coffee house, and his name was big, huge letters with his picture on this poster. And Pete saw that and left the 20 or so folks that were wanting his autograph and talked to him, put his hand on the shoulder of the young boy, and we went to a nearby tree, and Pete sat down under that tree to talk to this little teenage kid about why he needed to be humble, why his name should not be so big. And so here's this member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, founding member of the Weavers, writer of Where Have All the Flowers Gone and Turn, 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 and he marched with Martin Luther King, and he's done all these things all over the world, leaving his fans to go talk to this teenage kid about his poster. That taught me. Pete told me that day, he said, having friends is more important than having fans.
That's why giants are giants.
That's right. And it's that humility that I found a huge lesson. And Pete did a lot of things out of his heart, not for money, but because they were the right thing.
Was he a mentor to you, a teacher? Inspiration?
Much. Oh, very much so. Oh. Maybe not musically. Musically, I'm very different from him. But as far as finding the value of making the spotlight that you have as wide as possible to include as many others as possible is better than being selfish and trying to hog it all. And I don't mind talking about what we do and what we accomplish. I find it hard to talk about Michael. We can talk about the Song Farmers or the Caney Creek Motion Picture, because that's a movie about Alice Lloyd, a story that must be told, a Kentucky woman's story that must be told. You know, I can talk about those things, but, you know, I'm not going to talk about me, my personal feelings or politics or stuff, you know, things like that. And that's the lesson I learned from Pete. Focus on what your work is, not on you.
And they're not always the same thing. I mean, there are different things, and people need to keep part private.
Well, social media has become a cesspool of arguing and, can I use the word bitching?
you had me at cesspool.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also become a fallacy of promotion. You have a lot of sincere but small artists with limited audience presenting themselves as though they're stars. And I see that often because of other projects that I do, like Wood Songs and stuff. And I feel bad, because you can't say that's not the right thing to do, but I keep thinking of Pete with that young boy in the poster. You know, if Pete saw how artists were treating their careers today, I think he would do the same thing. He would try to take all of these social media legends with 15 likes on their memes under that tree and sit down and talk to them and say, it's not you. Your name shouldn't be this big. You're not a big star. Do good things with your work. Then you can talk about it later. But you have to take your music and do good things with it. You can't just sit in your basement, vibrate air for 3.5 minutes and think that you are deserving of adulation. You've not done anything. You've accomplished nothing. You know, there's a gazillion songs being written that nobody's going to hear. What are you doing with it? What are you doing with your music and your passion and your spirit and your heart? Are you doing anything to help the world around you with it? There's tons of things you can do, but if you're just sitting around trying to tell everybody how great you are, well, so what? You're one of a million. You've done nothing.
I feel for the artists, though.
I think what you might be grappling with is that everybody wants to somehow find validation for their music and art.
Not necessarily. So, all right, I have a poetry book. Few things are as invisible as poetry books. So if I don't speak about my poetry book on social media, or if I don't say, I have a reading here, come to the reading if you want.
But there's nothing wrong with that. That's good.
Okay.
That's good. What I'm talking about are folks who, with no audience, presenting themselves like they're the next Bob Dylan. And it's all coming from them. You know, they are their own promoter.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. I understand that. But if you're not doing anything to validate it, then you should be focusing on what Pete told that kid under the tree. You know, do good things with it first. Accomplish something with it first. You know, you're a poet. Can you go to 30 or 40 schools and get kids to listen to your poetry and teach them about poetry and encourage them to write poetry? I mean, well, what a beautiful thing to do. That's what I used to do. I would sing about the earth and nature in 4,200 schools. Nobody knew who I was. I wasn't trying to be a star. I wasn't trying to get a record deal. I wanted to sing about the earth and nature, and I wanted to play and sing in front of big audiences. So I would sing in front of 500 or 600 kids 3 times a day, 5 days a week.
You gotta get your 10,000 hours.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you're not doing it for the glory. Nobody knew who you were. You're not, you know, you're not on TV. You're not. You're singing about something that is important.
That's service. That is service.
Yeah. And so, but then when you do that, now you at least have something to talk about.
And combining service with humility and the desire to do something good, that's powerful alchemy right there.
Well, and you can use it to springboard into other things important to you. So I would sing about the earth and environment to all, you know, a few thousand schools. But then I read a story about 4 teenagers who committed suicide in New Jersey. And I said, well, if I can do this about the earth and the environment, can I sing about teenage suicide in high school and colleges? And can I use songs like James Taylor's Fire and Rain, which was all about his suicide attempt, and nobody realizes that's what the song was about? You know, and so I did 228 concerts to 250,000 high school and college kids, all about teenage suicide. Because I did the Earth concerts. And then because I did the teenage suicide concerts, I was able to do something about farm families. And so I did, you know, several thousand concerts on that. And then when I wanted to do something about the homeless and battered children, we did a project on that. You know, and so when it came time to want to do something like Wood Songs, well, I had a bunch of good work behind me already. So folks took it seriously this time.
It's track not, record, yeah.
Yeah, so if you can accomplish all that, maybe this is not a stupid idea.
Maybe he can have big letters on his name. Maybe his name could
my
be
name,
big letters.
Yeah, my name stays small. Wood Songs is big. My name is tiny. But it's but one series of good work moves into another.
Yes.
If you keep rolling your ball up the hill.
Yeah.
You can't expect others to do it for you. You have to roll your own ball up the hill. I learned that a long time ago.
Tell us about your connection with Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, well, I have connections with a lot of artists. Edgar is a sad story. And, you know, the way he passed away in Baltimore and his the tragedy of his life, and yet the brilliance of his work. You know, and there's a lot of artists are like that. Henry David Thoreau. I love Henry David Thoreau. Walden is a beautiful, amazingly written book that kids don't read today. And I was like, how hard can it be to do a play about Henry David Thoreau? And so I took all of Henry David Thoreau's main lines and all of Ralph Waldo Emerson's lines, and I weaved them together into a story. And we went into the opera house with the film crews from Asbury University, and we filmed the production of my Walden play that airs on public television every Earth Day. And so right now, this, as we're doing this, around the country, the radio stations are airing Walden Play and public television airs Walden Play. But it's because I did these other things first that I was able to get Walden Play produced. If your audience goes to waldenplay.com, you can watch it. Hmm. It's a beautifully acted and filmed thing. But I wrote that because he was my hero. On my next album, Edgar Allan Poe is taking front and center. So, you know, the audience can't see my T-shirt, but you can.
That's right.
But it's part of the family of fathers that I never had. Edgar Allan Poe, Henry David Thoreau, Vincent Van Gogh, Pete Seeger. You know, my dad died 5 days before I was born, so I never had that. So I looked to these inspirational figures as sort of replacement fathers. Edgar's not one I'd follow, but his work, I think, is incredible. As a writer, he's incredible.
Is it too forward to ask you about you as a father?
What do you want to ask me about?
Well, I mean, if you lose your father 5 days before you're born, that would affect you.
Yes.
And then you would think a lot about father-son relationship or father-child relationship. And then you become a father. What does that mean to you? I would think for myself, it's like, I want to be such and such and such father. Mm-hmm. And then you become father, and then you probably try harder than anyone else.
You know, you're touching on something I think that is it's very true for someone like me. You ache for something you never had, and you're not sure how to be it for someone else. And so because of that, you know, I can sit here and tell you that I've never been drunk in my life. I've never tried a cigarette. I've never touched drugs. 'Cause I wanted to be able to say that to my children as to why they shouldn't. And that I wanted to show them that working hard is more important than trying to be great. And to be, you know, that love is the greatest transaction of the arts. It's why I love you as my children. You know, there's nothing that my child can ever do, right or wrong, that would make me not love them completely. And they know that. And so when I created Woodsong's Kids, it was for my little daughter, Michaela, to be my co-host, which she was for the first season. Then Dance Lessons took over, and now it's Sarah Molly B. Cool's turn. But that's all by agreement. It's all good. But having your children love you is an ache that every parent hopes they can keep. Because in this world, it's very easy to see families drifting apart. And there's a lot of mental and emotional illness in the world, narcissism. There's a lot of I call it therapy addiction. I'm not knocking therapy, but therapy addiction is a bad thing because it teaches you to keep the injuries ripped open. There's no end point to it. And so I hope that as a dad, I help my children avoid all of that because I see it a lot. I see so many people struggle with it. Then they're hurting and they don't know why they're hurting. And you look at the world that we're in, you know, with the war and the way the economy is, and you turn on the news and everybody's fighting with each other and they're arguing and they're animus. And I'm like, let's be part of the peacekeeping army instead.
It's starting at home.
Yes, it has to be. That's why the front porch is the big theme of everything we do. Now, there's people that laugh at that. They hear me talking about the importance of the front porch, but that is a spiritual, emotional reality that I am proud to say that each one of my kids are artists. They're all artists. They all have musical and artistic ability that they're passionate about, that they engage in, that they're beautiful at. And this is the front porch spirit that I think America is losing. You know, the idea of home and family and neighbors and music and art being used to bring people together, not to sell. You know, money is irrelevant when you're looking at a world falling apart at the seams. And that peacekeeping army of artists and poets and writers, that's important. That's why we do the Woodsongs Artist Picnic a couple of times a year. There's like 20 cities around the country where artists will get together for one afternoon and create something brand new and then have a potluck dinner and a presentation concert. You know, you should come to the next one.
It's on my calendar.
Good.
Yeah.
And it's you know, they happen all over the country. You know, we create, here's that thing again. You do one good thing, you create Woodsongs. What can you do other good things with that? So like these artist picnics, people take it seriously because Woodsongs worked.
Yeah.
So they take this seriously. Yep. When there's floods in Appalachia or tornadoes in Western Kentucky, and I say, let's collect instruments and fix them up and give them away for free, everybody took it seriously because these other things also worked. And that's what I tell artists. Do good things with your work, with your music and your art, because it's more powerful than a hit record. And if you can do one good thing, you can do five and six other good things. And this is part of that peacekeeping effort. You know, we collected over 1,000 instruments that we distributed free to all the tornado victims. Then we did it again for Appalachia when there were floods. And it's because all these other things that we wanted to do were also working, so folks trust it.
Yes. Yeah.
They will trust their own efforts. They know that they can donate a $10,000 flute from Cork, Ireland, and put it in the mail to America because they know for sure we're going to give it to somebody.
And everybody wants to be part of something that is good and successful at the same time.
Well, they don't want their time wasted.
Well.
And their heart wasted, right?
Right.
My role is to make sure that we don't screw up.
I think that's fabulously said. I'm sure it's a whole lot more than that, but you're not going to praise yourself and give yourself full credit for everything you do. But I wanted to talk to you because I know that you're a legend, and I want your voice on the Accents podcast, and I want some of those loving, wise things that you said to be heard by my listeners.
Well, I think you're very kind to invite me, and I appreciate your work. I mean, I've watched you with admiration for several years. You've never given up. You've never quit. You include others in what your work is, which is exactly what you and I have been talking about for the past hour. Opening the spotlight up as wide as possible to include as many others as you can. That is the generous, loving spirit of the arts, and I think you epitomize that. You do really good.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Michael.
Can't end it any better than that.